Chakshulamilitam jena tasmai shri gurave namaha Sri Chaitanya manubhistam stapitam jena bhutale Swayam rupa kadam bhayam dadati svapandantikam Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 11, entitled The Lord Krishna's Entrance into Dwarka. Text number 24. Raja Margam Gate Krishne Dvarakayaha Kulastriyaha Harmayani Aruruhur Vipra Ta Ikshana Mahotsavaha Raja Margam Gate Krishne Dvarakaya Kulastriya Karmyani Aruruhur Vipra Tat Ikshana Mahotsavaha The public roads. Gate, while passing over. Krishne, by Lord Krishna. Dvarakaya, of the city of Dwarka. Kulastriya, ladies of the respectable families. Harmyani, on the palaces. Aruruhu, got up. Vipra, O Brahmanas. Tat Ikshana, just to look upon Krishna. Mahautsavaha, accepted as the general, accepted as the greatest festival. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. When Lord Krishna passed over the public roads, all the ladies from the respectable families of Dwarka went up to the roofs of their palaces just to look, to have a look at the Lord. They considered this to be the greatest festival. Purport. To have a look at the Lord is a great festive occasion, undoubtedly, as it was considered by the metropolitan ladies of Dwarka. This is still followed by the devout ladies of India, especially during the days of Julan and Janmashtami ceremonies. The ladies of India still throng up in greatest number at the temple of the Lord, where His transcendental eternal form is worshipped. The transcendental form of the Lord installed in a temple is not different from the Lord personally. Such a form of the Lord is called Archa Vigraha, or Archa Incarnation, and is expanded by the Lord by His internal potency, just to facilitate the devotional service of His innumerable devotees who are in the material world. The material senses cannot perceive the spiritual nature of the Lord, and therefore the Lord accepts the Archa Vigraha, which is apparently made of material elements like earth, wood, and stone, but actually there is no material contamination. The Lord being Kaivalya, one alone, there is no matter in Him. He is one without a second. And therefore the Almighty Lord can appear in any form without being contaminated by the material conception. Therefore, festivities in the temple of the Lord as held generally are like festivals performed during the manifestive days of the Lord of Dwarka about 5,000 years ago. The authorized acharyas who know the science perfectly install such temples of the Lord under regulative principles just to offer facilities to the common man. But persons who are less intelligent without being conversant with the science mistake this great attempt to be idol worship and poke their nose into that which they have no access. Therefore, the ladies or men who observe festivals in the temples of the Lord just to have a look at the transcendental form are 1,000 times more glorious than those who are non-believers in the transcendental form of the Lord. It appears from this verse that the inhabitants of Dwarka were all owners of big palaces. This indicates the prosperity of the city. The ladies got up on the roofs just to have a look at the procession and the Lord. The ladies did not mix with the crowd on the street, and thus their respectability was perfectly observed. There was no artificial equality with the man. Female respectability is preserved more elegantly by keeping the women separate from the men. The sexes should not mix unrestrictedly. So we have a description here of Lord Krishna's entrance into the metropolitan area of Dwarka. Just like we have a metroplex. Big place. What is the derivation of the word metro? Anybody know? Huh? But what is the Latin? Anyway, or Greek. Be interesting to find out. In any case, it's at least it is understood today to be an area which is highly populated. And so, although we sometimes get the impression that there were a few areas which were developed, ancient civilizations, but generally we don't hear so much in detail as we do from the Bhagavatam when they do anthropological digs. They come up with, you know, only fragmentary evidence of these lost civilizations, and so they have to speculate like anything. Just like that's what they do about India. They have this Harappa, you know, civilization in the Indus Valley, and they speculate so many things about it. I mean, you know, and they can't exactly understand it. And they admit, we don't understand it, we don't know, there's so much we really don't know about it. And you might ask, well, why don't they just read the Bhagavatam? Make it so much easier. In other words, here's the scripture, here's the book, the history. The Puranas are history books, itihasas. Here's the history books about these civilizations written by the persons of those civilizations, and yet they refuse to look at them, saying that these are not books written during those times. They are not books written by the persons of those civilizations. They're modern interpolations. And just to give these give a sense of antiquity, they imitate language of old. They purposely imitate older forms of language, even though they're written in a modern time. So in this way, you can see the inferiority of Eastern and Indian civilization is maintained, and the superiority of, you know, the Eurocentered theory that everything that came out of Europe was where it was at. It was the, you know, cradle of real culture and civilization. That's what they say. They say India was populated by Europeans originally. There were some persons living there who were driven out of their Harappan civilization and went into civilization and went south and became Dravidians. I mean, this is the main theory prevalent. They have some other theories. But anyway, the people who gradually dominated the Aryans were the Europeans. So whatever is good is made in England, as Prabhupada would often say. The British policy was like that in India, that even in Calcutta and Bengal, where they would make very finely spun, homespun cloth of the finest type, they would export it to England and then re-import it back to India with a stamp which said made in, or from England, from London, and charge 100 times more for the price of something that was manufactured, you know, a few miles away. So this is a type of psychological, you know, manipulation of the national consciousness, and it goes on, even today it goes on. I mean, you know, you buy so many different products and you have to really look hard, but finally you see it says made in China or made somewhere, and people say, I'm not going to buy a foreign import, I'm only going to buy American. And people have such, you know, strong nationalistic sentiments. In any case, this description today gives us a very clear picture of very advanced society, because it says it was a metroplex, a very big city. And a big city means big organization. You can't have a lot of people living together in a civilized way without some very expert management, systems of management. So we have to understand that there was a very evolved system of management, waterworks, just like they make a big deal about the aqueducts in some countries, right? Roman aqueducts, I think it was. You know, how they moved water from place to place. Or, for example, in the civilization of the Indus Valley, I believe it was, they made a big deal about the gutters, you know, how they removed wastewater. They were impressed by that. These are signs of intelligence, you know. And, of course, if they would just read, they would see that there's a lot more signs of intelligence, because the real intelligence is not how to manage, you know, the water that goes into your body and the water that goes out of your body. That doesn't, you know, perhaps it does take some planning when it's done by a million or more people at the same location. But the fact is, it's not a very interesting subject. The real interesting subject is how to get out of this material world. And because the Bhagavatam and the Vedas are especially concerned with that subject, most historians don't take any interest. They think immediately, ah, a myth. Anything that has to do with God, they immediately categorize, oh, this is a myth, because it has to do with God, and God is a myth. We've already proven that God is a myth, because we figured out that the universe works by mathematical laws, and it doesn't require God's presence. Things are going on without his presence. So there's no need of God. And besides that, whatever God can do, we can do. And we can usually do it better. And whatever we haven't figured out yet, we're about to figure out. So really, it doesn't seem that there's God. God is a myth. This is the nonsense which is, you know, basically underlying why people don't take seriously scriptural statements. They believe that anything which simply is about the subject of God is mythological. Gods and heroes. Of course, they're quite interested in their own myths. You know, when all you have to do is read the myths, you know, the heroes, myths and heroes, like today's heroes are politicians. You open up the magazine and you see such and such Democratic hero, such and such Republican hero, and all of their extended family members who are the heroines and how they assist them, or music heroes or sports heroes are given, you know, and they're real. They're very real. They're very real, and the God of the temple or the church, you know, we only admit to his need to admit to his existence once in a rare wild, perhaps on Sunday. You know, you go or you pray for a few minutes. So this is the situation as the Kali Yuga develops. Here, of course, we had a different civilization, the time during the Vedic culture, when everything was God-centered. Everything was God-centered. And ISKCON is special because even though it is a modern movement, it, you know, harks back to a very ancient time when people had a God-centered life. And so sociologists, you know, and anthropologists and other philosophers and religionists actually have a great deal of interest in ISKCON. And one of the reasons they do is they think that this is very unusual. How they feel that by looking at ISKCON, you can get some sense of what may have gone on thousands of years ago when people lived in a God-centered society. Things were very certain, very well established, clear, you know, harmonious. You know, you read, for example, the philosophy of Aristotle, and he has this idea that everything, you know, seeks out its own purpose, you know. I mean, he explained everything in that way, that each thing has its own intrinsic purpose and moves towards that end. And so the universe was seen as a very coordinated, meaningful, personal, you know, being, you can almost say, like an animal. They even conceived of it like an animal. But from animal it went to mechanical. They took out the personal element and said that there's no question of each object or each thing moving towards its own fulfillment. Everything's just moving by mathematics. Mathematical equations can explain everything. The universe is like a great clock. And, you know, somehow or other the clock just existed. Never mind that there was a clockmaker. Right? There's no clock that we can find anywhere in this world that wasn't made by someone. But this particular universal clock just somehow came into being at some point. Something kind of came into being, which they don't know how. I mean, they can postulate many ideas about how it developed from one stage to another, but how it began from the very, very start, no idea. No idea. And that's not scientific, Prabhupada said. That was not scientific. Scientists means someone who searches out the original cause, not the second step and the third step, the original cause. Until you can understand the original cause, why do you go to the second and third step? Now you may say, well, we're going backwards. We're going to go move backwards and finally we'll come. But you will not come to that original cause by any kind of empirical observation. And that's basically, you know, so much of what science has been up to now, empirical observation. Of course, the physics has become such a science that it's getting closer now to more Vedic conceptions. They have to, because it's not based any longer simply on physical observation. Anyway, when we study Western civilization, we do see that it goes through many phases, but the basic primary change in Western civilization is from religious to secular, from believing in God and God at the center to, you know, no God, godless. And therefore you have reactionary religious movements, just like now this presidential, you know, hopeful, a Republican hopeful, is like a super conservative evangelist type, you know, and it's just people are, they like some of the things he stands for, but they're scared stiff because he's a fundamentalist. And fundamentalists are notoriously dangerous creatures. You know, they can be very dangerous because whenever you study history, you'll see that anyone who believes too strongly in one thing that person is not very tolerant of other things. And so it can become a very dangerous situation, so people don't know exactly how to deal with this. They like some of the things he says, and yet at the same time, they are fearful. Just like there, here's an issue about the ladies of Dwarka and how they observed Krishna's coming. They stood on the rooftops, and Prabhupada makes some very clear statements here. He says they did not mix with the crowd on the street. They maintained their respectability. There was no artificial equality with the man. But notice Prabhupada says there was no equality. He doesn't say that. He says there was no artificial equality. What does that mean? What's the implication? When someone, there's no artificial equality. What does that mean? It could have a number of meanings. What would you say that means? What does it imply that there's no artificial equality? Yes? But, okay, that's true what you're saying. Now, if we just look at the words, no artificial equality, what does the implication mean?
That
just from the...
real equality.
That there is real equality, that's one meaning. Or it could also mean that there is no real equality. But certainly there's also no artificial equality. So there's two possible ways to see what the implication is. What the actual implication is, there is real equality, as you're saying, but not this artificial equality. What is the artificial equality, Prabhupada says? No artificial equality with the man. Female respectability is preserved more elegantly in keeping women separate from the man. The sexes should not mix unrestrictedly. So, you know, this is like the main or big issue of the day, and it really is a big issue of the day. When you take any subject in the university, there is always, no matter what the subject is, some part of it is generally devoted towards, you know, the issue of equal rights for the women, feminism. And everybody has their own explanation for it. But the reality is that they want total mixing, you know, no gender differentiation, unisex, just like you see unisex barbers, isn't it? Unisex clothing, unisex toilets, unisex dormitories. You know, the whole idea is that the only way you'll have equality is by eliminating the differences. But that's nonsense. Our philosophy is different than that. We say we will agree to disagree. There is unity in diversity. The only way to get unity is not by eliminating differences. Another way is by accepting the differences and not judging them. Qualitative way of saying one is better than the other. Just like you can't say a man is better than a woman. You can say a man is different than a woman. And you can judge one woman against another woman, if you wanted to, or one man against another man, in terms of certain ways. You can judge them against each other also, for that matter. But the fact is that the issue is not so much who's better or who's worse, but they're different. And one difference is, and the main principal difference is sex. They are constructed different sexually. And so, because of that physical difference, and because of how much a person is identified with their body, the mind is absorbed in the differences of the body. And so a person in a man's body thinks I'm a man, and someone in a woman's body thinks I'm a woman, and so they get attracted to the opposites. At least they used to. Nowadays, people get attracted to anything, including, you know, anything. I mean, it doesn't even have to be human, and it doesn't even have to be alive. People have become so sexually active, you know, more than any animals are, because animals know very well what they want. They want their own type. But human beings have become completely, you know, insane, actually. Part of the reason is this, you know, this absorption, fixation in this, you know, it's like someone who has been deprived of equality for so long. So everybody goes crazy trying to figure out the way now how to really make them equal. And they don't get to the right answer. So the right answer is not, you know, that we will just mix up. Because by mixing up, all that happens is everybody gets agitated. You know, when you put fire near butter, one will melt the other. So because of this random mixing of the sexes, you know, just so much encouragement towards it, you see what happens like at a modern day university, that students cannot concentrate on their studies. All that they're interested in is dating. That's their main interest. sex. You go to the university so that you can get away from your parents and have more sex life, which is the most outrageous, you know, perversion of what universities used to be for. That's why universities originally were not co-educational, because they knew very well that you don't mix the sexes together if you want to seriously educate people who are older, because they're going to get absorbed on a bodily platform. So they did maintain this, and we do so today. And because of that, we'll get criticized. We do get criticized. Our movement gets criticized as being sexist. And so they say, the first question is, why are the men standing closer to the altar than the women? That's the question. Of course, I have my answer, which is that they aren't necessarily having to do that. Like in Houston, they don't do that, because our temple is not very wide. It's just a very long temple. Like in Mayapur, they don't do that. The men stand on one side and the women stand on the other. They don't go back. So it's just practice. The necessity is, of course, someone could argue, well, then why don't you let the women stay up front half of the week and the men can be up front in the other half of the week? Because we're a little bit sexist, that's why. I mean, I can't give you any other answer except the truth. That is the truth. Or I could answer, because more men come to Mangal Arati than women. Of course, the women would say, well, more women come to the greeting of the deities, so then we should be up front at that time. In any case, basically, we are not sexist. And anyone who makes a careful study, I always say this, you know, will find that out. It is not a fact. In fact, unless one talks about the soul, you can't talk about equality. You can't. It'll always be a perverted type of equality. Because we do see each person here as a spirit soul with the equal ability and right to love Krishna and be able to be recognized by Krishna, irrespective of their physical, you know, gender identity. Therefore, that is the ability to actually give equality to persons. So we observe this Vedic culture was set up to properly. It was set up very nicely. It situated persons in a proper way to show respect to all living entities. Yeah, the ladies were highly respected. That's mentioned here. Their female respectability is preserved more elegantly by keeping women separate from the men. You know, how is there any elegance in unisex? Where's the elegance in, you know, a woman's, they cut their hair short, wear, you know, suits, do the, you know, it goes on and on and on and on. We had a discussion in one class, and finally I just raised my hand and I made the simple observation, which made everybody laugh, that the real cause of, you know, modern day the feminist movement was the invention of powdered milk. That was my offering to their class. That by evaporation of milk, you know, women could leave the home and go to work. And if they hadn't been able to do that, there was no question of women leaving the home, because they would have had to stay home to feed their babies their milk. So science does affect these changes. But the fact is that we can offer the world an ideal model in ISKCON, and that's what ISKCON is meant to do. It's not simply a philosophy in a book, but it's meant to be lived properly. And that depends on all of us, how far we're able to live properly and articulate the philosophy nicely, because people will ask us. These questions are on the minds of those who come to this temple. You know, why is it that the women sit separately from the men? You have to be able to explain this in a reasonable fashion. Why do you worship these idols? I mean, this question comes up right in the purport, and it's the main question that someone asks if they come into this temple and the deity curtains are open. You know, is this idolatry? And Prabhupada spends a lot of time in his purports discussing what the, you know, reason for deity worship is. And he makes the point that the Lord can appear in any form. You know, so we can give statements. There are statements from Christian books, you know, like Moses saw the Lord in a burning bush. God appeared to Moses in a burning bush. And that every Christian and Jew knows that. So they can't argue that, you know, God cannot appear in many forms, because he did appear. And there are other times when he appeared in different forms. And, of course, they may say, but he ultimately doesn't have a form. But there is nowhere that that idea is really emphasized in their scriptures, that God has no form. I mean, you call God the Father, that very clearly designates a form. You know, fire hydrants don't have fathers. Air doesn't have fathers. Who has a father? A son has a father. A daughter has a father. Children have fathers. And what does a father mean? There must be a mother. I mean, these are just common sense. Just take this word father that everyone accepts, God the Father. I mean, that's a very common theme, the Creator. Even when we talk about the Creator, you know, that you see the conception is still personal. It's not impersonal. It's very hard. This whole conception that this is an impersonalized idea of God, it doesn't come from their scriptures. It comes from their own inability to understand and accept their scriptures and have realized persons who could explain their scriptures. So we're going to have to explain very carefully our philosophy and try to touch on some of the themes in their own philosophy so they can relate to it and give them extensive knowledge. We have extensive knowledge, which is one of the greatest contributions our movement can make, is to distribute widely this knowledge. That's why Srila Prabhupada emphasized book distribution so much, because these books contain knowledge that is unavailable in any other literature in the world. There's no other literature, religious literature, that explains reincarnation and the law of karma, for example. And anyone who's a good philosopher has to admit the law of karma is the best explanation for many things which don't make sense, like senseless evil. Cannot be explained except by the law of karma. Senseless evil means when an airplane blows up in the sky and three, four hundred people lose their lives, what's the point? If there's a God, why did he let it happen? What's the point? You know, when a little baby dies sitting in its mother's lap in an airplane explosion, what's the point? How can that be fair? Where's the morality? There it is fair, because something happened in the past. Only karma can explain why this was not senseless evil. And philosophers will, you know, have to come to grips with that fact if they're unbiased. So there's a reason why Prabhupada's emphasizing the distribution of his books, because he knows that gradually the public, you know, as a whole, will become educated through reading these books and start to put two and two together. Even if their leaders don't do it for them, they'll do it. And karma now is pretty much an accepted concept by the majority of people accept the idea of karma and reincarnation. And they didn't 30 years ago when this movement began in America. People did not accept karma and reincarnation. Maybe, you know, 5% of the population in America accepted it. What do the figures show now? How many people accept the idea of reincarnation in the United States? 50%. I think it's more than 50%. I think it's 70%. Yeah, it's a very high percentage of people accept reincarnation. It's, you know, it's a very, very high number. So how is that? One of the main reasons is Prabhupada's books. Prabhupada's books are having a very, very powerful influence. And that's why Prabhupada just said, keep pushing the books out. Vegetarianism is having a very big influence. Again, Prabhupada said, you know, we don't need more temples, we need more restaurants and reading rooms. That's what he told me. He said, don't open more temples, open restaurants and reading rooms. He said, if 10%, he told me this personally in 1977, he said, if you can influence 10% of the U.S. population to give up eating meat, He said the entire atmosphere of the world will change, meaning that the United States influences the rest of the world, and 10% of the population, if they just become vegetarians, that in itself will be very powerful. So, you know, these, and of course Harinam, which we don't do enough of, but which is so important. It just, and people like Harinam, and it really does have its effect, chanting Hare Krishna. It has a very powerful effect. If we would go out more often, now the weather's getting warmer, and, you know, at least once a week, we should go out, because the names of the Lord are very, very powerful and purifying. So these are the three-pronged point of our preaching attack. And we should see ourselves as preachers. It's not enough just to, you know, go through the week. If all you do is go through the week, you know, making ends meet, making a living, chanting your rounds. Now, you may think that's a great achievement. I chanted my 16 rounds today. Oh, it is a great achievement, but it may not be enough to save the world. I mean, your chanting may not be quite like, you know, Haridas Thakur's chanting, or, you know, Gorkhashor Das Babaji Maharaj's chanting, where they can pray for the deliverance of the world. Usually when we chant, the only thing we're praying for is that I don't fall asleep. Or that my mind doesn't think, you know, like of 75 different things, you know, in each round. So it's questionable whether your chanting is delivering Dallas. It may keep you awake, and it might even advance you to some degree. Therefore, it would be beneficial if, in addition to chanting your 16 rounds, you did something to spread Krishna consciousness. And, you know, all right, let's, you know, I think each person can justify that they are doing something. A pujari can say so, and a gurukul teacher can say so, and someone working in the restaurant can say so. So I think that's the greatness of this movement, that it has set itself up in a way where just by being part of this movement, you are doing something. I would only argue that you can do more. You know, it's like, for example, no doubt anyone who does come to the restaurant does get benefited, but very few people do come to the restaurant. So you could think about that. And no doubt if you go, you know, gave people books, they get benefit, but very few people get books. I mean, it is still very few. When we count, you know, 17 soft books, you know, 3 hard books, 1 maha hard. You know, you think of the Metroplex. It's a very big place, the Metroplex. So, I mean, we are just barely, it's like, you know, the amount of books we distributed, the amount of snow that fell yesterday. You know, you must have seen all the snow that fell the night before last, right? That's what they reported, it's going to rain, snow, or sleet. And you looked and looked and looked and nothing fell. So three, you know, you can walk between the snowflakes when it snows usually in Dallas. It's not, just not much snow. In the same way, our book distribution is quite sparse. It doesn't blanket the city. So we have to increase these preachings. You know, again, we have our Indian community, and they are already inclined towards Krishna consciousness. They simply need to be encouraged. So if we befriend people, because what does preaching mean? What does sales mean? Mithranath's a salesman or Jivana. What's salesmanship?
Relationship.
Yeah, it's relationships, right? And what do they say? Establish. And what do they say about fundraising? It's friend raising. Right? Fundraising means friend raising. So, for example, you have a huge, I'll just give you an example, on Sunday, you have a large congregation of people come here, okay? And in the sanctuary where they take their prasadam, or especially amongst the Indian community, they're all sitting there, and you'd be surprised how thrilled Indian people are when a Westerner comes up to them and just befriends them as a devotee and tells them their story as a devotee. That's very endearing. They like that because It's very nice to meet someone. You know, there's the British and America itself here, you know, puts down such a heavy thing about American superiority, the American way of life is the best. And here are Americans who have embraced the Indian way of life. So naturally, any Indian will appreciate that if you just take the time to spend a little time and be friendly. But if you think, Sunday's my day off, I've been working 5-6 days of the week, and Sunday is when I can just stay at home and not have to bother with anything, that is one type of vacation, no doubt. But I would suggest that you might actually feel more relaxed by spending a little time Sunday preaching. You just might find more relaxation and more happiness in going into the sanctuary, having your Sunday feast, and just, you know, push yourself onto some unsuspecting Indian family and say, "Would you mind if I sat next to you?" And they're, you know, because of their nice culture, they'll never say yes. I don't want you to. They're not going to say no. I don't want you to sit next to me, like some American might say, "No, this seat is reserved." They will not say that. They'll say yes. Please sit down. And then you can ask their name and talk. And you know, I say this, and I have said it in the past, and the reason I have to say it again is because no one takes me seriously about this. But I do think that the atmosphere and the effectiveness of our preaching would be markedly improved if everybody would do something about it. Just like, you know, we have our Baladev sitting there sleeping in the class. You can give him a nudge. Just like our young people. You know, if they would take it upon themselves, Karunga Lula's here, and, you know, meet the young people of the Indian community as an example, which they don't do, you would find very intelligent people. They're always very intelligent, motivated to do. They're very intelligent. And they would probably like very much to have a friend like you. And it probably would help them to become Krishna conscious. But you have to take the trouble. You have to bother. If you don't bother, nothing's going to happen. You know, so instead of whiling away your teenage life, talking sweet nothings, you know, with your girlfriends or boyfriends, it would be a lot more intelligent to use the time to do some, you know, help to others. Be charitable, be kind, be generous with what you have. I mean, young people, you have been spoon-fed for 15, 16, 17 years, you know, a huge amount of Krishna consciousness. You know, it's like enough to last thousands of people, thousands of years. And you're just full of Krishna consciousness. And if you would just meet somebody who was interested, you could tell them all about it. So you just have to go out. That's what preaching means. People are interested. They are interested in what we have. They're just not going to run up to you and shake you and say, "Tell me about it, tell me about it." You have to be a little smart and get them to, you know, it's like priming a pump. Do you ever prime a pump? I know. At least I prime pumps because in Mayapur, priming a pump, the water doesn't just start coming out right away. You have to prime the pump to get the water to come out. So in the same way, you have to prime people to get them to start asking questions. They're not just going to run over to you and say, "Oh, I've been waiting to meet someone." You know, sometimes that happens. In fact, when it does happen, you usually think that person is weird. Anybody that's, you know, they say, I think they say that, right? Anyone who's too anxious, too eager is suspect. So, you know, if someone runs up to you with that much eagerness, usually, you know, you just say, "Oh, a weirdo." The best people are usually those who are a little, you know, careful and cautious. So you have to prime the pump. You have to go over to them in a bit of a subtle way and just say, "May I sit down?" And then just, you know, ask for their name and start to talk, and things will happen. So I would only suggest that we have worked so hard to build this community. We are working so hard to tolerate living in this community, because it is a toleration. You know, I mean, it does require toleration. We have put so much effort into making this community what it is. Now we should use it. What's the point of doing everything we did if we don't market it? And you can say, "Oh, well, we don't have enough money to market it," or "we don't have..." I say that marketing is, you know, what are you talking about? We've got hundreds and hundreds of people who come in to this community every week, and we don't market it to them. We just, you know, sit there. I don't know what we do. It's like, you know, it's like a businessman manufactures the products, rents the place, showcases it all. The place is full of customers, right? And everybody just stays at home eating their meal. Does that make any sense? That's what we do. You know how hard it was to build this temple room, how much it cost, the trouble we took. You know what it takes to dress the deities, how much time we have to spend on that, making the deity outfits, how much time the cooks spent cooking, how much time it took to run the restaurant, the cooks there working, right? The maintaining the grounds, paying the rent, you're all paying rent on houses. It takes so much trouble. So finally we get some people to come in here and everybody sits at home. I mean, think about it. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's actually, we are, you know, weird. We're the weirdos. I mean, that is completely weird to do that. It doesn't make any sense. So I think the real problem is that we don't actually understand that preaching is the essence, that preaching is pleasurable. I may not do what I'm talking about on a Sunday. I don't think most of you are in that category. I think that, you know, and you can say, no, we are. We're catching up with our houseware. I don't buy that you're catching up with your houseware at 6 o'clock on Sunday evening. I don't believe it. There's at least 60 or 70 adults in this community, and if 60 or 70 adults were active preachers, you know, for about 2 hours every Sunday, I think you'd see some very interesting results, personally. Very interesting results. You know, you'd be surprised. Just like Narottam met one gentleman, Indian gentleman, he started to talk about how, he said, you know, the older people right now, they want a place, older Indian community members, want a place where they can go for a weekend. And they go down to some place down such and such place where they've built a community. I don't even want to give it credence by even mentioning the name of the place. But anyway, you know, so the guy said, if you would build something here, we could build it. We could collect the money. So they started talking about a property they could buy right around here and build it. And, you know, so Narottam is now going to get into it and see if they're serious. But the point being, my point being, that people do have desire for religious activities. Every religion has many religious activities, like Sunday schools, you know, which again, by the way, we don't have. We tried it, but it didn't work. Although in Houston, it works. You know, they're building in Houston, that temple, that property we're building in Houston, which you'll see when we go down there, it's costing $1 million to build that building. And there are 10 classrooms. A big part of the building they're building are Sunday school classrooms, because they cannot hold all the Sunday students. Now, you know, I'd like to know how it is that they can do that and we don't. What is the explanation? And the explanation, obviously, is they care. They've gone out of their way to create that situation. And I would suspect, and I'm trying to tell you, that Indian people, Hindus, are no different than Christians. They've got a lot of, you know, religious things they want to do. And they're just looking for a temple that will facilitate it. But if all, and I'm trying to say that you can say, well, that's not our business, facilitating all the things they want to do. Everything you facilitate that they want to do will have some connection with Krishna. That's my point. Just like you think that everybody who goes to the restaurant is just coming there to be Krishna conscious. No. But can anybody doubt the fact that when someone goes to our restaurant that they're getting Krishna conscious? They're getting Krishna consciousness. Similarly, you know, Sunday schools are Krishna conscious. I'm just giving an example, and there are many others I could give. Like old people wanting something to do. You know, so if you build a building and they can all come on the weekends and stay there together, what do you think they're going to do on those weekends? Just sit in their rooms? No, they'll be here in the temple. You can then ask them if there are other things, services they can do. They'll do all kinds of services. If you have mail outs you want to have, they'll do that. It goes on and on and on. I mean, like, there's unlimited things they can do, and that's true of anyone. But it all requires our own interest in preaching. And everybody here feels, I'm just too busy, I don't have the time. Well, I say, okay, give us 2 or 3 hours in a week. You don't have 2 or 3 hours in a week? Is it really a fact? I mean, you know that's not so. And if you just say, oh, we've heard this so many times. Well, you won't have to hear it so many times, you just start doing it. So my, you know, request is like that. And I do think that Sundays especially is the time, no matter what you're doing, even if you're a book distributor, like some of you are. That doesn't mean that I've done it, or like, you know, yeah, Jivananda could say, well, I give the Sunday lecture, so I don't have to do what you're talking about. That's all right. Whatever you do, but in addition to that, is what I'm saying. In addition to whatever you're doing for preaching or not doing, you should also mix a little bit on Sundays. I mean, that has always, that was the old traditional Sunday feast in ISKCON. The big deal was you worked really hard for Sunday because Sunday was the day you got everybody to come. And there wasn't a single devotee that didn't plop themselves down next to a guest and start preaching. I mean, that was what the Sunday feast was all about. It was a big happening. You remember, Pajapa? Am I right? Not a single person would not do that. I mean, that was it. Everything was geared up for the Sunday feast, to get as many people there as possible, and then you just fanned out. I mean, I was very methodical about it. I remember it was so, you could count on it. I think I wrote about that in Servant of the Servant. I went to New York. I flew up to the Sunday feast from Florida, up to New York City, put myself in someone's office, I gave a lecture, told people about this program of traveling on the buses. Then I went up to the office. I got a few people to go out and talk with the others. I got people coming into office, and I went down the next morning back down to Florida. Already when I came to New York, I booked 5 tickets return, and all 5 seats were occupied with young men I brought back. And you can say, well, that was your preaching. The point I'm making is we did preach. You can preach. There are lots of people. I watch every Sunday during those kirtans. There are also Westerners in here. And there are Indian people who are now dance, which is unusual. And you might want to talk to them about how do you like that dancing. Because even if they don't like it, then you need to explain to them why it's all right. Because most Indian people think we should just do bhajan and not kirtan. They don't know the difference between bhajan and kirtan. And you have to explain that. And it's beneficial to explain it so that they get it off their mind. And that's one of the reasons they don't dance. Because it's not, you know, they just can't. They're not, the tradition in most of India is not kirtan, it's bhajan. You sit down and just clap your hands softly and do bhajan. You know, Bengal does kirtan. Bengalis do kirtan. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu introduced kirtan. And there is kirtan traditions in different parts. So you just have to explain that our sampradaya comes through Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and the tradition in Bengal is kirtan. So that's why we do it. Of course, then they may say, well, I'm not a Bengali, I'm a Gujarati, and so I'll go to such and such temple and not come here anymore. But you can tell them, well, look, I'm not a Bengali or a Gujarati. So what does it have to do with being a Bengali? Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is not a Bengali. They just happened to take the opportunity to appear in Bengal. He could have also appeared in Gujarat and introduced, you know, his movement through bhajans. But he understood that bhajans are too subtle. That's why he did kirtan, because bhajans are too subtle. Because it's just too, you know, it's not the right thing for the Kali Yuga. The Kali Yuga needs kirtan. Because this is a very heavy age of materialism, and therefore it requires a very powerful, forceful type of chanting, which gets people off the mental platform. If it was, you know, that's the fact. Just like you'll see, during an arti ceremony, everyone stands up. Now, you can say that they stand up because, and the main reason they stand up is because it's a way of showing respect while the Lord is being offered the arti. But I think that there must be some other reason also, because when you stand up, you don't just stand. I mean, it is a fact, people move a little bit, even if they're not accustomed to kirtan. So kirtan is for the Kali Yuga, for anyone. You can always get them off. If they say, I'm not a Bengali, I'm a Gujarati, say, I'm not either. I'm not even an Indian. So if you can argue that you don't have to come here because you're not a Bengali, then I shouldn't be here at all because I'm an American. In this way, engage in discussion, make friends. And of course, most of you, the best thing you can do is if you can invite people to your home sometime. If you make friends and then invite them to your home, most of you would never think of doing that. You'll invite me to your home, but you'd never think of inviting any of these guests to your home. But if you ever do, do you know what Prabhupada said about someone eating in your home? Yes. Prabhupada said that if someone takes prasadam, if you feed someone, they become obliged to you. And everyone knows that. And anyone with any culture knows this. When you accept someone's invitation, they become obliged to you. So if you invite people to your home, they become highly obliged. And apart from that, they become very convinced. Many people will not open up and discuss their doubts, etc., in a public place. But in the privacy of someone's home, they'll open it up. All right, I have spoken long enough. There will not be time for questions or comments because we went over time. Srila Prabhupada ki. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ki. Gaur Purnima ki. Well, one thing is that tomorrow is the public celebration for our Gaur Purnima festival. So if there was any day when what I said holds, if you can't do this tomorrow, I mean, I don't think then you're a devotee of Lord Chaitanya. If you can't come out and do some preaching tomorrow, tomorrow, Gaur Purnima is celebrated on Monday officially. That is our, you know, that is the Gaur Purnima day. But guests will not come on Monday. They're going to come tomorrow. So we are going to bathe Gaur Nitai. And I would suggest, you know, that you get into your best preaching outfit and mood and do some good preaching. In this way, please, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Nityananda Prabhu. Gaur Premanandi.